welcome to Shattering Myths. This day, which is the pagan celebration of Christmas, named after an erroneous deity, a man Christendom turned into their god, and based entirely on pagan traditions. Our program is devoted to the most important, to the fastest growing, and now the largest segment of society. To those who have come to realize that such religious practices, in fact, the entire religion behind this holiday that some 3 billion people around the world are celebrating on this day, is false. That it is counterproductive. That it's based upon a pile of widely accepted lies. And who also have realized that the world's political, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt. That they are counterproductive and that they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you are not celebrating Christmas on this day, or if you are celebrating Christmas and would like to challenge our condemnation of it, step up to the plate. Our toll-free number is 877-376-45. My pleasure to welcome Larry back. Larry, how are you?
I'm great. You know, Yahusha says, come out of her, my people, so you do not participate in her sins, so that you don't receive her plagues.
Exactly. You know, what's so interesting, of course, is that there's almost nothing Yahusha says that isn't already stated in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So when he asks us to come out of Babylon during the very last days prior to his return, then I would have to ask, in that particular case, is there maybe a tie-in with something Yahweh asked of Abraham? By the way, I understand we also have Kirk. You're not on the switchboard, so maybe it's on the guest line. Kirk, are you also with us?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi, Kirk. Let me ask you a question. Yosha's one of his last comments that's recorded through Yahweh Kanan to us is the one that Larry just quoted, which is, come out over my people, is speaking specifically of Babylon. So on the last day, according to Yosha, who is Yahweh in diminished human form, a sizable enough percentage of the world's population, perhaps even the majority, are still involved in being influenced by Babylon. Was there a request to come out of Babylon stated earlier that might tie into this one?
Well, he starts with Abraham. You know, come
out. Where was Abraham living when
one of the city states, one of the five little groups of cities that made up Babylon.
Correct. And Yahweh specifically said, walk out of your country, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, you can't come to me unless you get away from that.
Right. So we start with the first request to engage in a relationship with Yahweh, to participate in the covenant, and the very first request is, walk away from your country, and your country, in this case, was Babylon. And Yosha's last plea to humankind is, come out of her, my people. Yeah. Do you think maybe there's a connection there that people are missing?
Well, obviously they do, because they're celebrating the Babylonian tradition today in full force.
So. Yeah. Larry, have you ever stumbled across anything in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that speaks ill of Babylon, makes some associations with Babylon that would be undesirable?
Well, yeah, there's a good number of them. One, he talks about the Christmas tree specifically.
In Yirmiyah. Most of Yirmiyah is focused on the religious and political and military hypocrisy and malignancy of Babylon. And then
you want me to read that? I mean, it's
pretty
clear.
Let's read that. And then I'd also like, Kirk, when he's finished with that one, maybe you could share what is found in Yashayah 14, where Yahweh is equating Halal bin Shakar with Babylon, Satan with Babylon. It's kind of an interesting time. Why don't you share what Yahweh has to say about the Christmas tree.
Okay, it says, hear the word which Yahweh proclaims to you, O household of Yisrael. Yahweh says, do not walk in the ways of the Goyim nations. Do not teach the signs and symbols of the skies. For the Gentiles are confused and destroyed by them. For the customs.
But can I stop you there? Can I stop you there for just a moment?
Yep.
Because a lot of things just would pass over most people's heads. Because you know we're not disciplined students of history. We're not. Most of us are not particularly observant, and making connections is a skill set that's been neglected, under-exercised, if you will. So I want to make a quick connection between the practices of the Gentiles and the signs of the sky. Is there a correlation between Easter and the signs of the sky?
Well, there certainly is, and I mean, you know, we're 9 months earlier before this nativity scene they would have in Babylon, they celebrated the earth being impregnated by the sun on the Sunday nearest the vernal equinox, which is today's Easter, which was then called Ishtar. They didn't even bother
right.
to change
it. And during that time, the sign in the sky was that not only did the sun, it was the days and nights equal on the equinox, but that during that particular day, the sun is in the constellation of Taurus the bull, and Taurus the bull was the principal sun god image. As a matter of fact, when you have the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, the first god they manufactured was a bull. A golden bull representing the sun that actually had a disk sun between its horns.
Yeah, and so that's the day. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right. This is the connection that Yahweh was making. Right. And
right.
that the Lord was the name of the God represented by the sun and by the bull. In fact, even in Egypt, the principal deity of the pharaohs, other than in addition to being associated with the sun, was the Apis bull cult, and really time was measured in Egypt based upon this Apis bull cult. In fact, it happens to be the easiest way now, and the most accurate way to measure the actual timeline of the pharaohs is through the Apis bull quote. So the signs begin with Sunday, which is in commemoration of the sun god in pagan religion. So that's the first sign from the skies. And the second is Easter, the vernal equinox, when the sun is in the constellation of Taurus the bull. And it was the highest day on the pagan calendar. But and you're right, when the sun impregnated Mother Earth, represented by the Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, Astarte, who became known as Ishtar, then 9 months later, human gestation period on the winter solstice.
Solstice, yeah.
Yeah. At that time?
When they would have the birth of the son of the sun, Tammuz.
Right.
And it says
Tammuz, who became Osiris. I mean, Glenn did a beautiful job of explaining how yesterday how Osiris represents Tammuz. Isis in Egypt represented Ishtar or Astarte, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, and Horus in the Egyptian religion represented the sun, the Lord in that religion. And then how we move from there into the Greek religion, where Dionysus is the son of the sun, and then into the Roman religion, where it's Bacchus. So
okay.
All directly related to the Gentile, universal Gentile religious theme. And there was really nothing more central to all of the Gentile pagan religions than this combination of the spring equinox and the winter solstice and the events associated with the sun and the birth of the son of the sun. All of this is wholly and completely pagan. And Yahweh just says, don't do that.
Yeah, and there were customs and traditions, and that's why he says, for the customs and traditions of foreign nations are delusional. They cut down trees from the forest, the work of their hands with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it down so it will not totter. Their trees are like finely decorated cultic objects. They cannot speak. They cannot walk. You know, don't revere them. From them, there is nothing beneficial. There is nothing like you, O Yahweh. You are powerful. You are great. Your great and personal proper name is mighty. Who would not revere you? Indeed, it is your due. For in all the Gentile nations, in all their empires, there is none like you. They are altogether stupid and foolish in their doctrines and their teachings of delusional idols made of decorated trees. Wow.
Wow, you know, there's so much to yeah, there's so much to that. It's not just that the Christmas tree is the center.
It's the tradition
of the Christian tradition,
yeah,
and the celebration of Christmas that began in Babylon and endures all the way to this time, including things like the Yule log and the Christmas wreath and all of those kind of traditions. But the thing that is so insulting here, and if there's one point that we drive home today, fellas, more than any other thing, it's that Christmas and Easter are not innocent mistakes. The line that, well, that's not what it means to me, is not acceptable. It's not going to fly with God. That the point that the prophet Yirmiyah is making here is that by substituting a false religious celebration and icon, and by showing reverence to and including this into your culture, what you're doing is trading that which is useless, dead, and false, that which will teeter over, for that which is real. It's a trade that people have made. They've traded the real God for these phony and ridiculous religious symbols. It's not an innocent trade. Deadly. We'll be back. Both Larry and her, both members of Yahweh's covenant family. Guys, the point that I wanted to underscore is a tie-in between the first thing that Larry said, which is Yosha's last comments, come out of her, my people, speaking of walking away from the influence of Babylon. And the first thing that, as Kirk mentioned, that Yahweh asked Abraham before he could engage in a relationship with Yahweh, before he could be part of the covenant, he had to walk away from Babylon, walk away from his country.
You know what I find so strange is that this information is not—it's not like it all of a sudden you had to go to some obscure little book somewhere and read about this. I mean, I knew about Talmuds and I knew for years, you know, that obviously if a child was going to be born, it'd be in the fall, not in a pagan holiday. So I was listening the other day. I've been working, so I've been listening to y'all on tape, and I remember you were talking about with Larry, and y'all were talking about the unpardonable sin, and so I immediately connected that with what you were just saying a minute ago. For years, I would listen to preachers, and they would talk about they couldn't figure out what the unpardonable sin is, and of course, y'all would tell you exactly what it is. It is when you hide His word and you change everything and substitute another religion for it. So it's not like it's a big secret. And that's the thing. He hates the absolute most. So that makes it even more disgusting, these holidays.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there are two references to the unpardonable sin. And they are they're related, but from different perspectives. And Yahweh actually etched in stone the unpardonable sin. It's the third of the three statements that he etched on the first of the two tablets. And that statement was written using two Hebrew words that could convey, and actually does convey, two different yet very related thoughts. And the two words are NASA and Shav. NASA can mean to uphold, to uplift, to promote, to advance, or it can mean to deceive and to mislead. And Shav can mean to belittle, to demean, and it can also mean to advance, to be associated with that which is deadly. And Yahweh says that, you know, throughout the Torah, in his test of who speaks for him, that a false prophet, someone who claims to speak for him but does not convey the same message, that person is deadly. So the third statement, etched in stone, incorporating both of those comments, it specifically says that we should not, do not, promote, advance, or uplift that which belittles Yahweh's name, that which demeans Yahweh's name, and do not uphold or accept that which is lifeless and deadly in Yahweh's name. Because Yahweh will not forgive those who belittle his name, those who have his name go for naught, and those who deceive by promoting that which is deadly, deceitful, and lifeless. So that's the unforgivable sin. Go ahead.
Can you get much worse than celebrating Thomas' birthday and calling it the Lord Jesus Christ and everybody trying to associate it with the Messiah? I mean,
no.
Come on.
No, you can't.
So,
because there's two aspects of this. One is diminishing Yahweh's name. When you promote a religion based upon a misnomer, Christ and Christianity and Christian and Christmas, and what you're doing is removing Yahweh's name, disassociating Yahweh from your belief system, you are guilty of the unforgivable sin. You have caused Yahweh's name to go for naught. When you replace Yahweh's name with a Jesus, with a Christ, with a Christian, with a Christmas, you are absolutely, directly, and unequivocally guilty of the unforgivable sin that Yahweh etched in stone. And the second part of what you said, Kirk, is correct.
Mm-hmm.
That when you advance a lifeless doctrine, like the Babylonian religion and a celebration that grew out of the Babylonian religion, with your understanding of God, then you are guilty of the unforgivable sin. That sin is not forgivable. Now, we are going to talk about it when we return, because there is a conjugation associated with this that resolves the issue, at least for some of us. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Misery. I'm in a conversation with Larry and with Kirk about Yahweh's specific instructions. And when you consider the unforgivable sin as it's etched in stone, there is be set free and receive vindication element to the unforgivable sin. And it has to do with the conjugation of the verb. Each of the ten statements that are etched in stone, when it provides an instruction to us, were they written in the perfect or the imperfect, Larry?
They would have been written in the imperfect.
Correct.
Excuse me.
And
that means it's an ongoing affair. So if you
correct.
Walk away from it, then it's
correct.
It's no longer on you. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Correct.
One of the other things that ought to be pointed out in that is that he actually uses the word Shoah, which is today Shav. And
yes,
you had told me, I was not aware of it until then. I looked it up. The rabbinical vowel pointing system to get rid of Yahweh's name is called the Shav system, which
right.
means deceit. Unbelievable
yes.
that they could do that.
Yes.
But,
yeah, it was one of the most profound, shocking revelations in my studies when I was translating this particular passage, and this is transliterated Shav in almost all lexicons, and I'll sometimes use Shav just in case people listening want to look it up, and it's always transliterated Shav. Well, there is no V sound in Hebrew, so it can't be Shav, and the letters are actually the Hebrew waw. And the Hebrew waw conveys the O sound. So it's the system. And it's interesting that in the transliteration of Shav, they actually ignore the ain at the end of the word, which would have provided the A sound at the conclusion of the term. So anyway, it's important to know that in that very word, the rabbinical corruption, the masoretes, which is to vocalize, they chose a term to describe their system of providing diacritical markings. And they called that system shav from this verb, shoah.
And you want to tell us what shav means?
Yeah, to deceive, to mislead. And what's so interesting, of course, is in rabbinical, and we're as opposed to rabbinical Judaism as we are to Pauline Christianity. We are as opposed to those religions as we are to Islam, as we are to socialist secular humanism. So we're not just picking here on Christianity because this is the celebration of Christianity's Christmas. But the Masoretes, it's interesting. The first claim they made was that Yahweh's name, no one knows how to pronounce Yahweh's name, and out of respect for the name, we won't pronounce it. Now, of course, that is in direct conflict with what Yahweh said. Did Yahweh write his own name in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms?
All over 7,000 times he did it.
Yeah, there you go.
Exactly right. 7,000 right. times, as a matter
did,
of fact.
Did Yahweh use different letters for his name that aren't included in the other thousands of words of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms?
Yad, He, and Wah are all
okay.
They're in Torah.
In the noun Torah, which is the book where he introduces his name, does the noun Torah tell you how to pronounce the two He's in Yahweh's name as well as the Wah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We get the O in Torah from the Wah, and we get the Ah in Torah from the He, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So all you have to do now is pronounce the Y, and the Y in Hebrew is the same as the Y in English. And so it's Yahweh. I mean, that's all you have to do to figure out how to pronounce his name.
What was Adam's wife's name? It was Chawa, wasn't it?
Right.
put that Yod in front of there, and you're there.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just put the basis of Yahweh's name is based on the verb Haya. You know, it gives you the Yah sound in Haya, which means to exist. But
which is a lovely way to put it, because we know now, because of special relativity, existence means that he lives outside the constraints of time.
Correct.
And he can see the past, present, and the future all at once. So that name encompasses the fact he can give prophecy and they'll always be right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very few things that are as important as understanding the correlation between Hebrew verbs not being stuck in time, not having a past, present, or future tense, that the basis of Yahweh's name means to exist, was, is, and will be, and Yahweh identifying himself saying the closest thing to what I actually am that you would understand is light, and how on light, on a photon of light, time exists. The past, the present, the future exist simultaneously. Time does not flow in the ordinary sense on a photon of light. And then you correlate all of that to prophecy and understand that because Yahweh was not constrained by time like we are, he is able to witness our future in our past and therefore prophecy is not predicting the future. It's reporting on the future in our past.
Right. And of course, that negates the idea of a happy birthday, too. You know,
yes.
I mean, think of it. It's insane that God could be born on some given day.
Right. Because he's eternal, and he's eternal in time. It defines his very nature. So anyway, to finish this thought, on Yahweh's name, the rabbis came up with the idea that it could not be pronounced, and they started to promote that, and then they took it to the next level. They said, out of respect, it can't. We shouldn't pronounce it, even though it's written with the exact same 22 letters as every other Hebrew word throughout the Torah, prophecies, all of which we do pronounce. And the word Torah tells us how to pronounce it. But then they went one step further, and that they said that all 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet were consonants, and that there were no vowels.
Well,
and unless they provided the diacritical vowel pointing, that there would be no way to know how to pronounce the words in Hebrew.
That must have been a shock to the people that were already speaking it, huh?
Yeah, particularly since, and you're right there, doesn't Yahweh tell us to listen to his word?
Mm-hmm.
How can you listen to his word if you don't recite his word?
Uh-huh.
And how can you recite his word if there are no vowels?
Yeah, you can't. You have to make those sounds with your mouth, or you can't speak. Or
you're
very limited to speak.
Right. All vowel is. A vowel is an open mouth sign, sound. A consonant is a closed mouth sign. And it's when you look at Hebrew words like Torah, for example, Haya, for example, it becomes immediately obvious that there are five vowels among the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. It is just, it's breathtakingly obvious. And so this whole notion that you need to have the Masoretes, which means to vocalize, provide diacritical vowel points to an alphabet that already had five vowels, it just shows how over the top deceitful they were, and you can figure that out just the way that Kirk did here. All you got to do is say, "Wait a minute, Yahweh tells you us to listen to what he had to say." We're told that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is to be read in public. Yahweh spoke it to them.
He must have known how to say his own name, huh?
You think that he knows how to write his own name?
I think so. It begs the question to me, though, these rabbis, when they're doing that, and then later preachers and priests and everybody else, they don't believe the Torah at all.
No, they really don't.
I mean, that was
the Torah says, this is my name for all time, for all generations, the way I want to be remembered, Yahweh.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody says opposite of that, they're saying they're speaking in opposition to the Torah. Aren't they?
Right.
So how could anybody embrace the Torah and speak in opposition to the Torah?
Right. As a matter of fact, one of the most important verbs in Hebrew is kara, which means to call out, to be called out, to read, to recite, to be welcome, to invite, and to summon. Kara is as important as any verb in all of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And Yahweh
associates of the Mikre.
Right, and which are the invitations to meet with Yahweh, to be called out of this world, be welcomed into his presence, which we are in a position to understand and respond to the invitations when we read and recite his invitation as they are proclaimed in the Torah. As a matter of fact, the book of the Torah that you find the invitations is actually named
Kara,
which means to call out. And so Yahweh associates this verb with his name.
To Leviticus. They changed that to Leviticus, didn't they?
They did. Kara. They changed it to Leviticus.
Yeah.
Now, this system called the originally named Shoah and then changed to the Shav system was specifically designed by rabbis to alter the Hebrew through the diacritical markings of the rabbis to corrupt the pronunciation of Yahweh's name. So rather than Yah, it becomes Yeh. Every letter in Yahweh's name had its pronunciation changed by this system, which is a poster child for the unforgivable sin. But, and this is what is so important here, this is why if you look at Abraham, do you think there was a likelihood that Abraham participated in the religious and political culture of Ur of Babylon prior to Yahweh introducing himself to him?
Well, sure. He was in. He couldn't walk away from all society and be part of it. He lived there.
Yeah, that's correct. Before I came to understand the Torah and came to know Yahweh and engaged in his covenant, I was an ordained Christian minister. I taught Bible studies out of Paul's letters. I celebrated Christmas and Easter. I misled people. I was an evangelist. I was absolutely, unequivocally guilty of the unforgivable sin. But yet I've been forgiven. How is that possible?
Well, because it was written in the imperfect. You're not continuing to do it.
Correct.
It's all predicated on doing it consistently all the time and never stopping.
Right. So for all of those who are listening to this program, we may hear an archive of this program, and who celebrated Christmas, who have celebrated Easter, who go to church on Sunday, who are currently Christians, you are presently excluded from a relationship with God. You are not saved. You have no knowledge of who he actually is. But all of that can be resolved. And all you have to do to resolve it is two things. One is be willing to walk away from your religion. That means every nuance of your religion and your national culture that is inconsistent with Yahweh's teachings, you have to be willing to walk away from. And by the way, it's also written in the imperfect. It's an ongoing process to walk away from it. You don't go one day to the next. I know this wasn't the case with me, and it may not have been with you guys either, where you went from, all right, one day I am a evangelical Christian, a minister, and the next day I am wholly and completely opposed to the Christian New Testament.
No, I was thinking the other day when I don't know whether it was with Larry you were talking to yesterday or, you know, when you said in the conclusion of Chabahuk, and you said, you know, there's no Christians in heaven. He can't save them. He won't save them. He scorns them. He can't even stomach them. And I couldn't have said that 7 years ago. I would have just, I could understand it, but it'd be hard. You know how you kind of have a little revulsion?
Right.
You go, oh, gosh, really? You know, because everybody I know and all my family and people I love are all Christians.
Right.
So it's hard to do it that way.
Right, and you have to do it over time. It's over a process. But if you look at Yosha's statement in his instruction on the Mount, as he's first affirming the Torah at the beginning of it, but at the end of it, where people come to him, they don't know his name. So it's just like Christians. They're trying to refer to their God as the Lord, not knowing that Lord is Satan's title and Satan's name from Baal. That they're calling him Lord, Lord. And he says, you know, those who calling me Lord, Lord, none of them will be admitted to heaven.
They left it, but none of them, though, in the translations.
Of course, yeah, but that's if you look at the right now, he was speaking Hebrew, so he would have used lo, but the translation of Matanya, which was originally written in Hebrew, the Sermon on the Mount was delivered in Hebrew. Matanya was originally written in Hebrew. The Hebrew copies were destroyed by the Romans and by the rabbis, and so all we have now is the oldest manuscripts are written in Greek, but even in the Greek translations, it doesn't mean that not all of those who call me Lord, Lord will enter heaven. It actually says no one, mm-hmm. not a single individual calling me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven. And this goes right back to the heart of what the topic that we're talking about. When you replace Yahweh and his name with Christian and Christmas and Christ, then you don't know Yahweh. And if you don't know Yahweh, he is not inviting you into heaven. And the prerequisite to being invited into heaven is to know who he is. If you don't know who he is, he doesn't know you. And critical for us to understand that reality. Now, there is a related unforgivable sin in the Christian New Testament recorded, and it is to belittle, demean the set apart spirit.
Ruach Kodesh.
Yeah, the Ruach Kodesh, which is the maternal manifestation of Yahweh's nature. And the reason I think that it's written that way in the witness writings is that if you listen to Yahweh's invitations, his Moed Mikre, to be called out of this world and to meet with him, four of them have a very specific instruction, and that is instruction is to answer the invitation and to come into the presence of the maternal manifestation of his light. The set-apart spirit is the maternal manifestation of Yahweh's light. If you demean, if you belittle her, if you negate the set-apart spirit as the maternal manifestation of Yahweh's light, there is no way to be part of the covenant. You can't be adopted into Yahweh's family. You can't be perfected. And so I think they are absolutely related. Earlier, Kirk, I suggested maybe we should share the comments between the same Lord, Baal, and Halal bin Shakar, the actual name of the adversary, and Babylon. It's actually written right in the heart of the prophet Yeshayahu.
Oh, that was like in 14 or something?
Right, 14. What it basically says is that the adversary, Halal bin Shakar, that's his name. You'll read Lucifer in your English translation. Yeah. That is not Lucifer. It's Halal bin Shakar. Halal means to be arrogant and to uplift oneself. It can also mean to radiate light. So it has a positive and negative connotation, but it does a beautiful job of associating the fact that the adversary, Satan, is light. He's a spiritual entity.
Yeah.
So he is light, and yet it also conveys the dark side, which is arrogance. Halal, son of Shakar. Shakar is the rising sun.
Mm-hmm.
So it's telling us that Satan shall be this arrogant light of the sun. When the sun is arrogantly, inappropriately lifted beyond just a burning orb in the sky that provides warmth and light to our planet, to being a deity, to being the supreme deity, then that is the explanation of the name Halal bin Shakar. And if you look at what Yahweh says about him, the first thing he says is that he sought to be considered above the Most High. So he wants to be known as God. And so in every religion, you've got a deity other than Yahweh that people worship.
And just connecting the dots a little bit, he raised himself above, so he put his little temple to Islam on top of the mount. So,
right.
I mean,
yeah, the Dome of the Hoofyprint, the shrine of the Dome of the Rock, and then the mosque, the farthest mosque, also right there on the Temple Mount. That's Allah, who was modeled after Satan. Allah is greater. Yeah, exactly.
Every religion on earth, really, especially most assuredly, Roman Catholicism is based on the mystery of Babylon. In fact,
correct.
Allah isn't the first deity to be worshipped in the form of a crescent moon. That God's name was literally Sin, and that was in Babylon. So, I think the two will merge again. You know how we had talked yesterday about the foreshadowing of Sukkah, or the foreshadowing of Teruah, or, you know, all the foreshadows of the Moed Mikra. I think we're going to see a melding of all the evil. The first ones were a foreshadowing of the end, and I think Christianity will meld with Islam in the end. That's my opinion.
Yeah, we've got Richard.
Would almost be perfect.
The megachurch pastor who has actually written a book called Chrislam, Merging Christianity and Islam. And while the moron called the Pope Francis on his To the City and to the World declaration on the pagan celebration of Christmas in his pagan institution around his pagan circular park out in the Vatican around the pagan obelisk, spoke of harshly of the Islamic State. He did everything he could to differentiate the Islamic State from Islam, as is most of the world. And he, like his predecessor, has reached out to Muslims, kissed the Quran, spoken of Islam and Christianity sharing a common denominator. And the fact is, they do not. The only common denominator that is actually consistent between Islam and Christianity is that both Paul and Muhammad were demon-possessed. And that both Muhammad and Paul served Satan. And that in both religions, the God that the religious are worshiping is actually Satan. That's the common denominator. It's not the one that the Pope suspects. It's not an Abrahamic religion, because Abraham didn't have a religion. We'll be back with Larry and with Kirk after the commercial break.